Hello there, Geraldine Doogue with you on Saturday Extra with another instalment of RN Summer on this New Year's Eve. It's a time for a bit of reflection generally, so I hope you enjoy the discussion that we held at the beginning of the year at the ABC's Ultimo Studios about the challenges and the opportunities for the year ahead, that being 2016. Let's have a listen, with the benefit of hindsight, to an edited version of what they had to say about the year we've just lived through back in February this year. Well, this evening we're attempting to make sense of 2016, an unsettling year, it looks like, with higher than usual uncertainty about economic matters. You might have seen that our future fund's buying more bonds, indicating a pretty safety-first approach to investing our money. The gold market's booming for the same reason. Amidst renewed concerns, quite serious ones too, about just how viable are Europe's banks. And one headline this week put it all rather punchily: will our children ever experience growth? So we can take this up in questions later if you like. We're seeing huge numbers of people on the move, and this is changing politics, community emotions, and maybe the whole notion of borders. The skilled observers of the US say it's certainly in a foul mood, to quote my RN colleague Tom Switzer, looking at its presidential election so far. What sort of mood are we in here, you may well ask, in our election year, with the PM's view that it's a great time to be an Australian? So in our best Saturday Extra way, we've assembled a terrific panel, I hope you'll agree, to consider the challenges, but also the opportunities, which might be a bit less clear. And let me introduce our panel quickly: Heather Ridout, Michael Wesley, Andrea Miles and Tim Soutphommasane. Now, I'm going to introduce each of them as I go and ask them a particular question. The Reserve Bank Board member and chair of Australian Super, Heather Ridout, I'm going to ask you, Heather, what I'm going to ask everybody.
It's always good to go first,
Geraldine. Would you care to nominate a significant event or idea that you think will shape 2016?
Well, I think the big events that are going to shape 2016 really are the US election and the Australian election, and the ideas that emanate from that. And if you look at what's going on in America, I mean, your view is probably the one I share too, that people are angry over there. And you look at the New Hampshire primary and you've got people at opposite ends of the spectrum, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, you know, absolute polar opposites. One hates government, one loves it. You know, you don't get much more divided than that. In Australia, I think this election will be fought about Australia's future, and I think we're pretty fortunate that really both Bill Shorten and Malcolm Turnbull gravitate to the middle. And even though they fight a lot, they're not extreme and they're not polar seekers. And I think that's a really good thing for Australia.
Because, polar seekers.
Well, they're not kind of people who really want to live at one end
or the
Do
you think it
the
is
other.
The American is a battle for America's soul? I mean, do you think it's as big as that, or do you think it's just slightly more strident than usual?
I think there is a bit of that. And I think America's such a complicated place. There's sort of New York and the East Coast and there's the rest. And I think sort of Hillary is a machine type, and they've known her for a long time. She's a woman. That's not going to go down that well. I think they'd prefer a black African man to a woman, being completely honest about it. And I think that's really hard. It's a bit like here. The American economy's doing okay. It's growing reasonably strongly, strong enough for the Fed to put up interest rates for the first time in, you know, a long time. Unemployment's come down substantially and employment growth is strong. In Australia, we're making this big transition out of mining into a more services-based economy, and it's going all right. It's not brilliant, but it's all right. And as for kids not knowing growth, we are growing at 2.4%, which is the envy of the Western world. I mean, Europe would like 2.4%, Japan would love 2.4%, China wouldn't like 2.4%, but, you know, it's not bad. So I sort of feel what we ought to be talking about in the idea spectrum is, well, what's going to really keep that going and increase it and make it more inclusive and more sustainable? And I think Malcolm and Bill Shorten are trying to work around that. And these new ideas, new thinking, this culture of embracing a bit of uncertainty rather than being frightened of it is a really good thing.
So Michael Wesley is from the ANU. He's Professor of International Affairs and Director of the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs, and I think well known to us as a foreign policy specialist. And his most recent book was Restless Continent, Wealth, Power and Asia's New Geopolitics. So what do you itemise, Michael, as key events likely this year?
Look, I think the big picture trend that I would nominate, Geraldine, is the rise of geoeconomics. That is the use of economic power by very large economic powers to achieve strategic objectives. Now, this is something that I think has been on the rise for about the last 5 years, probably since the end of the global financial crisis. And it will continue to intensify, I think, this year, and it will continue to shape our region. I'd agree with Heather. I think the American election is going to be a very interesting one. But in a way, it doesn't really matter who wins the American election. I think whoever wins the American election, we will see a much more robust United States policy towards China. The Obama years have been an experiment in trying to change the relationship with China by being a lot more conciliatory. I think all sides of politics in the United States now regard that policy as having failed. And I think the rhetoric that we're going to see in the American election towards China, to the extent that China does figure in the American election, will be much more strident. So I think when you have major economies in this part of the world, the United States, China, Japan, starting to compete with infrastructure, with trade deals, with a range of other economic measures for the allegiance and the alignments of smaller countries like ours, I think we've entered a really new age, a really different age that is going to be a lot more complex and difficult to navigate.
Yes, I'm going to come back because you're not one to sort of spur fears, but you think we really might have to be aware of a new feudalism. So I'm going to come back to that. Now, Andrea Miles has been listening to this, I would have thought, with a great deal of interest, because Andrea has got a special interest in China-Australia relations. She's the CEO of the China-Australia Millennial Project, or CAMP, which is an entrepreneurial engagement project, and it matches 100 young innovators. We've covered it on Saturday Extra, from Australia with counterparts in China. And you're also a former head of the Australia-China Business Council. And to prove what a complete all-rounder she is, she's also a co-founder of the Sydney Roller Derby, or is it Derby League? I don't know. So, you know,
we say Roller Derby.
Derby League,
days,
okay.
Yes, that's
so
true.
What would you nominate?
Well, for me, digital transformation, innovation, I mean, these are things that have just been, you know, currents for at least the past 10 years. I think we can see this really, really start to embed this year. For me, with a China focus, the interesting part of China's transformation is this shift towards innovation. You know, manufacturing is only a 2% growth in China. When we look at services, it's growing at 12%. In China. So there's an interesting transformation taking place there. Some of China's biggest companies are taking place in this digital innovation space. And a fact which people might not necessarily know about, but the world's largest VC is actually now the Chinese government. So they
venture
are
capitalist.
Venture capitalist firm, yes. So they are investing heavily as a nation into transforming from manufacturing to services to this, I guess you could call it from made in China to created or designed in China.
Yeah, but will they be able to pull it off?
Well, it's very interesting. You can take a look. So in March, we see the release of China's 13th five-year plan. And, you know, the Chinese government has a bit of a reputation, I guess, for being quite mysterious or perhaps not very transparent, but in some ways...
Just a bit.
Just a little, just
yes.
Slightly. But in some ways, you can take a look at the five-year plans and see what is on the Chinese government's mind, at least officially, and what will roll out. And innovation is the core of this upcoming five-year plan. I mean, I feel like if you can see a vision, it will come to life. What I would like to see is the linkage of innovation in Australia. We have one of the most innovative prime ministers really talking the talk of innovation and putting some funding behind it. I'd love to see that matched up with a China story, which is also one of national transformation.
Okay, well, we'll watch. And Tim Soutphommasane will be watching as well. He's the Race Discrimination Commissioner. He's a political philosopher by training and is the author of, which I've been reading, a very interesting book called I'm Not Racist, But. It came out last year. And he's a key voice in the ongoing debate about our evolving national identity, whether it truly represents all of us, but also what a humane and critical patriotism might feel like. which is because I think you're wary of being seen as the thought police, aren't you, in whatever emerges in 2016?
Well, debate's always healthy, but how we conduct debates is always the crucial test. And there are some challenges at the moment when it concerns identity and culture. We need only look at what's happening in Europe to really get a sense of how urgent some of these questions are. I think of what's happening in Germany, for example, and the challenge that Angela Merkel has as chancellor there, whether she will remain as chancellor in 2016. And who would have thought that she would be faced with this challenge, with mounting criticism about how she's handled the intake of refugees from the Middle East, when only a few months ago she was being lauded as a visionary leader with the courage to open up Germany, to tell her country that they could do this, in the words that she has used. And yet, after an incident like what happened on New Year's Eve in Cologne, the ensuing public debate, there are now serious concerns about whether she can continue the course. And that, for me, really illustrates the fear and anxiety that exists around questions of immigration. What's happening in Europe, the debates that are occurring in Germany and elsewhere,
Sweden particularly too.
Indeed, the significance of those debates aren't limited to Europe. I have no doubt that we'll hear echoes of those debates here in Australia as well. And it'll be a test of our national character too, particularly in an election year. We are taking 12,000 Syrian refugees in addition to the intake of refugees we have. How we grapple with this will be very interesting to follow this year.
Well, except, dare I say, at the time when she did announce it, I know there were all sorts of people applauding her. I thought it was high, high risk all along. I thought, whoa, Germany, be careful, be careful. And that's come true in, you know, some ways that I couldn't have imagined with that New Year's Eve thing. So, I mean, what do you take out of all this? Because they're not simple answers, are they, about this?
There are no simple answers, but if I would choose one thing, I would say that numbers might matter. We are talking...
Might not borders, more perceived borders matter too?
Well, they're not just perceived borders, they're real borders as well. But in the case of Germany, you've had more than 350,000 refugees arriving there in one calendar year. You've had at least 1 million that have arrived in Europe in one calendar year. And when you have movements of that magnitude, they do create challenges. If you don't respond in a disciplined way, if you don't carry public opinion with you, then you may well face questions of legitimacy with the stance that you have with refugee policies. But it's a reminder too of the need for perspective in the debates that we have here in Australia. Now, we don't have porous borders. We don't share a frontier with any other country. We have a moat in the form of an ocean, and the numbers that we have are relatively small when you compare it to Europe. So it does give us an interesting perspective on the flows of migrants and refugees.
Well, it was pretty staggering when I was preparing for tonight to see that Sweden of all people, had evicted 80,000 last week, because Sweden and Germany have borne the brunt of it, sort of started talking. Really, it sounded like an Australian comment, you know, we've got to keep our borders safe. We've got to be much more sure of our testing, etc. I thought, wow.
And you're seeing a rhetoric that is framed in very negative terms around immigration gaining momentum. You're seeing far-right groups becoming more active in Europe. And it's interesting to compare Australia as well, because here in the last 12 months or so, we have been seeing anti-Islamic protest movements that have been gathering force. What you're seeing here is fear and anxiety being given increasingly vocal political expression, and increasingly by organised groups at the community level.
But I mean, Michael Wesley, you've written very interestingly about this issue of globalism you talk about, and I'd like you to develop that, because your point is that there is this new wave of it's almost like a massive draw card, and people will cross the world in order to get a safe life as they see it. And this has all sorts of implications for the politics as we've known it.
That's right. I mean, I think that that the refugee crisis that we're experiencing at the moment is unfortunately starting to add some momentum behind the weakening of the forces of globalism, the idea that, you know, that really was the product of the end of the Second World War, that human beings should have the potential to range across the world, to access all of the Earth's surface, to go wherever they like, to get products and so on from all over the world, to share information on a worldwide basis. I think one of the things that I fear is that the forces that really underpinned globalism, things like the United Nations and multilateral institutions, ideas like the universal responsibility to protect people in crisis, all of those sorts of things, just general cosmopolitanism that underlay so many countries, have now come under real assault or are being significantly weakened. And there doesn't seem to be a good news story coming out anytime soon. The one hope that I had was that the global economy remains global. And yet today I went to a speech by Warwick McKibben,
former Reserve Bank member.
And he was very pessimistic about the volatility in the global economy, the fact that regions like Europe are seeing real imbalances that are going to lead to further sudden shocks in the global economy. And I came away thinking, well, you know, there goes my last hope, really, for strong globalism. What I really worry about, Geraldine, is that as the rivalry between China and the United States deepens, and I think it's inevitable that rivalry will deepen in the years ahead. This is a rivalry over primacy, over who leads in this part of the world, and perhaps more generally, the competition will become so intense that globalism is the victim of this, that the idea of the free flow of information, for example, when we have countries like Russia, like Brazil, starting to talk about taking themselves off the World Wide Web and off the world of information flows and create their own national intranets, if you like, that's particularly worrying. That is happening in China. The fact that the Chinese internet is increasingly firewalled from the rest of the world. This is something that I think is really needs to be focused on and thought about. And I don't see much attention to that. I see a lot of attention among world leaders about immediate problems, about immediate crises, I guess understandably so. But what's actually happening to that texture of globalism, I think, needs some attention as well.
Now, I do invite you all to interact with it. Don't wait for me to direct traffic. I will happily. But, I mean, does this keep you awake at night, Heather?
I'm not as pessimistic. You know, if I look at Australia, we have a skilled migration program, a couple of 100,000 people a year. We have a visa program on top of that of another 200,000+ a year. We have a refugee program, on putting aside the 12,000 Syrians, of another 30,000 or so.
Which about four have arrived.
So you add all that up, and in any one year, we take, you know, 450,000-500,000 migrants into this country. And I think, I've forgotten the statistic, but over the last, you know, 8 or 9 years, we've taken 2 million net migrants into Australia. I mean, it's incredible. This country keeps doing it. And I feel very proud of that as an Australian. And I think even though we've got this very, very serious crisis at the moment in the refugee space, which I think, frankly, from my perspective, just makes this debate we've had in Australia about these poor souls coming here, you know, however many there were, tens, maybe 30,000, when there's a million children and mothers and running away from these atrocious conditions. And it puts our kind of policies into a very dark perspective. On the globalisation issue, I think the volatility and the uncertainty of the world economy is a problem. And I think when you've got big economies like Europe, you know, really struggling, they're growing. Europe is Australian super. We're finding opportunities in Europe. We just put a whole lot of money in infrastructure in Europe. There are opportunities for investment there, but it's doing all right, but it's really got a lot of central bank, you know, support. Japan's trying its hardest to get out of 20 years of stagnation, but it's, you know, it's proving to be because they're not really willing to embrace enough reform. The Chinese are still growing 6%. And I agree with Andrea, there's a transformation going on in China. The issue that I find fascinating is the Chinese have about 30 people in their Bureau of Statistics, and so it's a very strange beast growing, understanding Chinese economic statistics. Mm. But trying to measure the services economy in any economy is a very hard thing to do.
Sure.
And all it's the end, as you quite rightly say, Andrea, it's the engine of growth in China, but they find it hard to measure. So it is a transformation. But I think Xi Jinping is a nationalist, and Michael's comments are very pertinent. And, you know, if you had a Donald Trump who's a nationalist and you had him in China and you had Marie Le Pen in France, you know, that is a nightmare scenario for 2016. But
well, also,
I don't think Marie Le Pen will happen, but you never know.
And I mean, Andrea, I can't really imagine them rushing to China and China's borders being vaguely porous or open. I mean, in other words, is this just the West has just got to cope with this?
Well, when we talk about China, quite often we start to talk in quite monolithic terms. And for me, I like to think of China as sort of five different countries in a way, five different regions, certainly. You know, the West is wildly different to your first tier cities such as Beijing and Shanghai. So I think when we start to talk about what is happening in one China, you know, or we start talking about how the Chinese feel, we really can't take that approach. We're talking about a really significant chunk of the world's population who are incredibly diverse at very different points in their own personal transformations. You know, perhaps they're going to uni for the first time in several generations. You know, perhaps they're starting to find that they're able to purchase cars, able to purchase houses, or at least lease them for 99 years. So I think when we talk about that, I'm quite optimistic for some senses, you know, for some segments of the Chinese population. I think it's getting very, very interesting in what are called second tier cities, which are not your Beijing or your Shanghai, but they're still cities of which eclipse the size of Sydney. So we're looking at, you know, 5, 6, 7 million people. It's getting very, very interesting there. It's not yet overly congested. Obviously, there's a pollution angle, but in terms of job growth, opportunities for young people, which is obviously my particular passion, we're still finding quite a lot of optimism there that perhaps we might not be seeing in very crowded areas such as Beijing, where people aren't being paid as much as they were for, you know, the same job several years ago. So when it does come to China, we really have to think about this in sort of quite a nuanced and a detailed sense.
Yes, I suppose, Tim Suthamsan, do you agree with the Prime Minister that we have the most successful multicultural society in Australia or not? I mean, is that something that can aspire to actually learning about those second-tier cities? That's not the general discussion we have in this country, I'd put to you, about how successful it's been.
It really depends. At one level, we are very good at celebrating our triumph, and every Australian loves to hear the fact that we've been a tremendous success story as an immigration nation since the end of the Second World War. And there are good grounds for saying that very few countries have managed to conduct such ambitious programs of immigration as we have. It is a reflection of our goodwill and of our generosity that so many people have come to Australia to start a new life here. And the support for our multiculturalism is also very robust. About 86% of people believe that multiculturalism has been good for the country. Now, compare that to Europe, where you would have close to the opposite. We are a successful society, but we can't be complacent about that. We've been successful because we've had a public commitment to diversity. We've had laws which guarantee equal opportunity, and we've had political leadership that have, for the most part, been very firm in expressing a commitment to tolerance. In the language of the current Prime Minister, mutual respect has been an important value.
I suppose it was that surprise move. What I have taken is the surprise move of Angela Merkel. That was what seems to have caused the shock. It was not the move, it was not necessarily, I mean, it was the people coming in, but it was the fact that there was a policy, they thought, people thought, most surprising people that you read are sort of saying, what's happening? Is there a small conspiracy to sort of blindside us all? And you sort of think that is dangerous talk in Europe, isn't
and,
it?
And you hit on something that's very important for us to recognise here, which is the need for populations to have a sense of ownership around immigration projects. The fact that Australia and other immigrant settler societies, for want of a better phrase, can point to immigration as something they've consciously decided to do as a nation-building project means that you have a certain bulwark against
against fear and hysteria. But if you're talking about societies that aren't accustomed to dealing with immigration or feel that they're not exercising, to return to a point that was alluded to by Michael, exercising their sovereignty in taking in people, then you can have a disconnection between popular opinion and elite opinion. And that's a gap that we have to be really careful of. I don't think we have the same gap here as you would in Europe or perhaps in America, where the sentiment is very different. But these things can change and change very quickly.
Well, actually, there was a great quote from Martin Wolf from the Financial Times, who's been on the program, hoping to get him back, talking about precisely that. The rebellion against the elites, he was talking about the American election primarily, is in full swing. The vital question is whether and how Western elites can be brought closer to the people, Michael. Do you agree? Do you think that's what's at stake?
Look, I'd be careful about generalising the American experience to other Western countries.
He just thinks it's a sort of classic play. Demagogues, this is where demagogues come in. You know, they start sort of saying, hey, this society can be run much better.
Sure.
And it's easy. Just let me do it.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with him there. I mean, I do see the rise of people like Marine Le Pen in France and elsewhere, but they're generally not terribly successful. I don't see a Sanders versus Trump kind of contest, as Heather said,
here.
I find it hard to see in the UK. I find it hard to see in Western Europe. So we haven't seen it in Canada. I'd be a little bit careful about generalising there. I think we do have an issue with inequality, certainly, but whether that inequality kind of transforms in the Australian experience into a hatred and a suspicion of elites, I think that kind of pathology is most advanced in the United States because of their very deep Republican traditions. You know, this suspicion of government, this suspicion of the machine, this suspicion of East Coast elites. You know, we are an egalitarian society, but I don't see that same suspicion of elites here, and I just don't see it in Europe that much anymore.
I think also, you know, in the US, the GFC has left a huge overhang, and the fact that middle-class people haven't had a wage increase in real terms after taking into account inflation for 20 years in the US, these are very difficult things for people to swallow. And even now, even though employment, as I said, has improved hugely, a lot of people are marginalised from the workforce. So they look at all those people buying Park Avenue apartments for $17 million, and it's just all crazy, whereas they're working for the minimum wage, which, you know, has just been increased to about $10 an hour or something, you know, in Australia.
The three richest Australians
crazy.
Now own more than the million poorest Australians.
Yeah.
But that's pretty amazing,
but
isn't it?
I tell you, in Australia, we I mean, this is one of the problems, you know, I feel very strongly about having a very robust safety net in Australia. You know, I think we're lucky to have it. And when people start to mess around with it, you start to mess with the fabric of society. You have a strong, robust safety net, and then above it, everybody has to try and do their best as a citizen to contribute and to look after themselves. But I think America's really never had that tradition. Europe, of course, is another whole problem with the elites there, because there's Germany with an economy that should have a mark which is, you know, twice the strength of the US dollar. You know, it's got euro interest rates and the euro, and, you know, it's crazy. So they're very rich. They can take a million people, you know, if they really want to, they can pay for it. They integrated East and West Germany not that long ago, with Angela Merkel being part of that process. Whereas you've got Spain and France with unemployment of 10-25%, economies in the ditch, pretty useless leadership. To have a refugee crisis
on top of this
is a very hard argument. And you know, frankly, you can understand them saying, well, these people, you know, in their laissez palace, they don't know anything about my life. And, you know, I think Angela Merkel is actually a very practical person. And I think she put her head out there, right out there. But it's obviously something she believes in, and she's willing to spend her huge reservoirs of political capital built up over a long period of time on this.
We'll
and I suspect she might lose, but she may not.
What about fears around really depraved conduct by, for instance, the Islamic State group, Michael? We just had the respected analyst Sydney Jones speaking about her fears of further IS-Daesh expansion into Southeast Asia, our neighbourhood. In terms of predicting this year, what sort of relationships do you think need to be strengthened? And do you lie awake at night about IS?
Look, I do. I mean, I think IS has really pioneered a new and extremely virulent model of non-state violence. It's a model that has like all successful models, taken little bits of what other groups in the past, like Al-Qaeda, have done successfully, but it's grafted incredibly effective abilities to use media to reach out to new populations. One of the things that's particularly worrying to me is that even if the Syrian crisis were to finish tomorrow and all of those Syrian refugees were to go home, what we are seeing is the progressive use of population displacement as a tactic of war and as a tactic of statecraft. That is the tactic not only of IS, but of the Assad forces. What we're seeing at the moment in northern Syria and the Russian air attacks is the very strong possibility that Russia is doing this as well. You know,
put pressure on Europe.
Pressure on Europe, exactly.
Right.
Vladimir Putin has for a long time disliked Europe. He doesn't like the unity of Europe. And there is a very strong case to be made that he is using the displacement of people and the driving of people into Europe as a geopolitical tactic to further erode Europe's unity. So this is another big challenge that we face.
So that's a rational fear, in other words. I try to think sometimes when I think about the year to come of what's irrational and what are rational fears, and that's quite a rational fear then.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we might see is instead of the kind of generalised attack, you know, the big picture 9/11 style attack, what really keeps me up at night is the thought of the proliferation of these small attacks. People using knives, people attacking people randomly on the streets. That to me has a much greater danger in it of eroding our social cohesion and achieving the objectives of these groups than the major big picture attacks.
Does that ring true to you, Tim?
I agree with Michael. The seeds of distrust and division can be sown very easily through a single incident, and it doesn't take much, and it will be very difficult to eradicate the threat of terrorism. What's important for us is to ensure that our multicultural success story isn't fatally undermined by taking in messages of division and hatred. That's what IS would like us to do, to entertain the notion of our society being irreconcilably divided. What we must avoid is judging entire communities based on the extremism of only a few.
Might it not also be praising when it works well? I've been saying for a while, why is there not more curiosity about things like the I'll ride with you after the siege? Why isn't there more curiosity about that effect of society?
It's a good question. We do celebrate our diversity very well, but quite often it's at a very superficial level, at the level of lifestyle or food. But if we're more willing to take time to think about the true impact of our diversity and how we deal with it, then we may be surprised by the results, as you say. There's no substitute for having face-to-face contact with someone from a different background. That is how trust develops. It develops through familiarity and a willingness to open up your mind and your experience to those of others. But much easier said than done, and everyone always overestimates or overstates their ability to do that as well.
I'll jump in here because Tim and I are sort of, you know, one kind of brainchild here. It's really interesting, I think, that we're comfortable with diversity to a certain point, and then after that we start to get nervous because it starts to be complicated and we don't really know the answer. And I think a really interesting approach is to take a look. I mean, for me, I love our diverse society, and for me, I love innovation. This is what is going to unlock innovation in this country, is the fact that we are diverse. So if you look at any fantastic ecosystem, it is not homogenous. You know, you do not have one type of seed just, you know, proliferating in perpetuity. You have a range of different competing and evolving different circumstances, and the outcome is not yet determined. That's what an evolution and what a change is. So, you know, when it comes to sort of being prescriptive or predictable about, or predictive of what's going to happen here in 2016, we live in a diverse society. It has a range of different variables. There's a lot of health within that ecosystem. And what I get excited about is the fact that we may not know that outcome. What I would love to see.
Dare I ask you if your parents feel the same way?
My parents do not feel the same way.
They don't.
No. So I come from quite a working class background in regional New South Wales. And for a long time, I was asked China. Why China? But I was asked that by the general public as well, you know. So it was, it's quite a monocultural place where we grew up. However, when you take a look at the statistics of Australia in general, you know, most people have either a parent or a grandparent that was born overseas.
Well, it's up to 50%, 50 to 60 with parent or grandparent.
Right. Places are full of different nationalities. You know, some of the factories that I used to represent.
Professions aren't necessarily.
Yeah, but they have 56 nationalities in the Holden factory. 56 nationalities were there at any one time. And they all had to kind of work together, and the English wasn't always, you know, the common language wasn't always particularly crash hot. And
what I would love to see.
It's quite deep-seated multiculturalism in Australia.
We get nervous about it because we don't always know the right answer. You know, nobody wants to offend anybody generally, you know, so we're kind of looking for that canned answer. But I think what I would love to see Australia become is a nation that spots difference and sees that as a strength. So you come from a different society or you speak a different language. That's a strength in my startup team. That's a strength in my employer. Yeah,
I totally accept what you say, but one of the very – the writing in Europe is to say, yes, we've thought that. We also see that integration and an acceptance of certain values and codes and mores of the host country are also critical to be overtly accepted. Now, do you agree with that?
Yes, I think so. I think shared value is massively powerful. When we look at other countries, they're human beings who also want the best for their kids, a great education, you know, a great yummy dinner on their table. There's a lot of really sort of core, great shared value that I think when you start to get to know somebody, you uncover that stuff.
When the world, and you now China, you'd know all about that. China values stability over just about anything else, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that's part of the problem, you know. We're rattling along and, you know, everything's okay. Oh, we're happy to deal with difference, like women going on boards or, you know, women in the workforce or all this stuff. It's all great.
When
everything's okay. Until you reach things are unpredictable and unstable and uncertain, and then people want stability and they want the sameness.
Absolutely.
So it's hard to
Which is terribly normal human behavior.
It is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But that's why I actually get quite excited by China's slowdown. And I know that that's a little bit of a controversial statement, but if you think about if China was a person and they were 1 meter tall, in the 80s, they were growing 17 centimeters every year. They were growing at 17%. Now that's starting to slow down. So if you were a person and your growth was slowing down, your bones would get stronger. You might have some time to think about how you want to develop and the things that you might want to tackle rather than just this gangly body that was constantly growing. So slowing down in China, greater harmony, greater stability, I don't think it necessarily is as black and white as, you know, one thing's good, one thing's bad. There'll be great things about both.
Well, look, just in the little while we have to go, I also noticed that Nia Korn's Korn Group brought out their Feel Good Edition Happiness Guide. And his judgment was that it's got that way that if you say, well, I'm not happy in Australia, given the worries around the world, what sort of person are you? Because you've got to be, you know, Australia's a lucky country. You've got to feel good about living in Australia. But were we a happier nation in the past when life seemed simpler? This is what he's found. And there's a great quote here I want to throw into the conversation. This is a man in his 50s. When I was a kid, you went to the beach and you didn't get home as soon as the street lights were turned on. Nowadays, everyone's a pedophile and anyone with a tan and a backpack has a bomb in it. And, you know, again, I suppose Tim Soot Pomasan, is it difficult for someone like you who's trying to keep a useful watch on the temper of the times when there are people saying, God, do we have to live as fast as we do now, you know, in this pressured, intense way with such sort of fears, universal fears? Is that how we have to live?
Nostalgia is like putting on a distorted lens and looking through it at life. So we need to be very measured in how we think of the past and how we think of the present. But one thing we do know from a vast body of work that is done is that getting richer does not necessarily mean that you get happier. As a society, we have grown richer. We're perhaps unique as a country that has experienced more than two decades of consecutive economic growth. But more often than not in our public debates, we get a very different picture painted of where we are. So perspective perhaps is the best prescription.
Michael?
Oh, look, I just look at my kids and the young people who are coming, starting at ANU just this week. I look at the vast opportunities that are available to them that weren't available to me. And I think they're the luckiest generation that we've seen yet. And probably their kids will be even luckier, one would hope.
And Heather, do you get people saying that to you quietly? It's not something that people broadcast.
No, and that's right. People always yearn for the old days. And I also come from a country town, and you know, it was a pretty quiet, simple life. And the life my children lead is much richer, much more interesting. And I think stop the
more
world
more fragmented, that's, possibly though.
Yeah, it is, and more pressure probably. Mm-hmm. Although the pressure to get an education to find a way forward was a pretty major incentive. I think we have to live in the present and give it our best shot.
But, you know, it does make you think, Andrea, I think.
Yes, it does. You know, my parents worked extremely hard to make life and our town better for me than it was for them, you know. And some of that involves things becoming more diverse or complicated, or, you know, there's we sort of want that, you know, for the next generation. You have more than what I did. There's a really great quote which says, you know, the youth of today, they rush here and there and they don't respect their elders and they don't listen to their teachers. And it's from Socrates.
I know. It is from
right?
Socrates.
Right. So I think what the constant here is that each generation is different. You know, like somebody who's 50 is going to feel a different way about this present moment on this very interesting ball of rock hurtling through space than somebody who's 10.
Look, I think I'm being very quietly wound up by my people whom I must obey. So I would like to thank you all very much, Professor Michael Wesley, Heather Ridout, Dr. Tim Soot-Pomasan and Andrea Miles. Well, I hope you found that pertinent. I certainly did, listening back to that recording from February of this year, trying to make sense of 2016, the year we've just lived through. Some things have changed, but I'm sure that those conversations about refugees and economic growth and terrorism will continue into the new year, 2017. Well, to another type of reflection altogether now, this time about the oldest things in the world, a photographer's tale, up next.